From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Salman Rushdie joins us for the hour ahead. The celebrated Booker Prize-winning author has a new book out which is written for both children and adults, a magical journey called Luca and the Fire of Life. We'll talk with him about his new work as well as a range of other topics in an hour, which you're invited to participate in by phone, email, or postings on our website. That's all next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Booker Prize-winning novelist Salman Rushdie joins us in studio for this forum hour, one of the world's most celebrated authors. He recently published his 11th novel, Luca and the Fire of Life, a companion novel to an earlier work, Harun and the Sea of Stories, and a book intended for readers young and old. He's also the author of four works of nonfiction and a collection of short fiction. And he edited two fiction anthologies and is a distinguished writer now in residence at Emory University and has served as president of the Penn American Center, and always delightful to have you here with us. Good morning.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
I didn't know whether I should say Sir Salman.
No, please don't.
What is Bachelor to Knighthood? What does that mean, by the way?
It means nothing, actually. It's just, I mean, it's an honor. You know, it's a great honor because it's just, in England, it's just the way they, it's a kind of lifetime achievement thing. So it means that somebody, some group of eminent people thought that my work was worthy of noticing. But beyond that, it doesn't get you any favors, you know. You don't cut to the front of the line or anything like that.
No separate category of Bachelor II? What is that?
No, that's just, I think they've just got tired of using the word British Empire in their honors. So now instead of having a Knight of the British Empire, you're just a Knight Bachelor, which you can be even if you're married.
Well, you also are called Commander in France, right?
I am a Commander of the Order of Arts and Letters. The French are more noble about these things.
Covered with glory. Speaking of commanders, by the way, I wanted to ask you how Hitchens is doing. It makes me think of his father, of course, because he writes a lot about him in Hitch 22.
He does,
and he missed, actually called off his tour when he was supposed to be on here.
Mm-hmm.
And you two are close friends for listeners.
Yeah, well, he's battling away. You know, I mean, he's really ill. But, you know, he's still, the thing that's extraordinary about Christopher is his ability to keep going when most people would crumble. You know, he's just, last week
debated Tony Blair.
Debated Tony Blair in Toronto on the subject of faith, good thing or bad thing. Guess which side he was on. And he won the audience vote by 2-1.
Actually, in fact, one of the lines that I always remember about God is Not Great, his book, was your line. I always say Rushdie's a great comedian. People don't know that side of him. Said you should have taken the great out of the title.
Yes,
it would have been more apt for the content,
yes,
right?
Just one word too long. Yeah,
one word too long. That's the editor in you. This new book, let's talk about this first. I know you're excited about it. And I remember when we talked about Harun, you said that your son, this is your older son, said it needs jump. And you said this was the best form of literary criticism
you've
received.
Yeah, I showed him the first few chapters of the first draft, and he rather politely said, well, Dad, some people might be bored. He said, not me, of course. I'd read it, but some people. I said, why? What do you mean bored? And he said, then he used this wonderful phrase. He said, it doesn't have enough jump in it, which I immediately understood. You know, and it's one of those wonderful phrases whose meaning is clear the moment it's said. And so I thought, you know, I can do jump.
You got jump in the new one?
Yeah, this is full of jump. And what is good is that, you know, when I rewrote it, he approved it. He said it had sufficient jump in it. And so both of them actually have been very good critics of these books.
You also talk about sometimes your work in terms of chamber music or full orchestra. This is where in the world of music, metaphorically?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's not 600 pages long. So in that sense, it's not a massive book. But, I mean, I think of it as on a par with anything else I do. I mean, I think actually Harun and this book, Luca and the Fire of Life, are really, for me, the two most enjoyable books I've written. So just at the level of pure pleasure, they're right up there.
I could tell you were having a good time with this. In fact, you know, we both are lovers of 60s music and rock and roll, and I thought this could be titled Magical Mystery Tour.
Well, that would be, yes, the Beatles' worst album.
No, not talking about quality, more exactly. About titles.
Yes, that's true. It could be. It could be. And I, one of the things it's about, if you want to talk about it as a grown-up, is about the what I've always been fascinated by is the relationship between the world of the imagination and the real world that we live in. You know, that on the one hand, you have this world of dreams and fantasy and make-believe, and on the other hand, a practical, you know, everyday, solid, material world. And even though we think of these two as being very, very separate, they're actually not that separate. If you think about it, almost everything that we now take for granted begins as an act of the imagination. You know, a microphone does. You know, a radio does. You know, you have to, before you can make a wheel, you have to imagine a wheel. You know, so actually the relationship between imagination and reality is much more fluid. You know, things cross over all the time.
And for many fiction writers, imagination has more substance and truth to it, perhaps, than what we call reality.
Yeah.
Plus, when you're talking about the imaginative and the real, it's at the center of this book is storytelling. I mean, the Shah of Blah in his Panama hat is the great storyteller, and you're really writing about what imagination can create and what it does create.
Yes.
And it's video games, though, too, isn't it?
Yeah, but also the fear that storytelling, I mean, the storyteller in this book is not well and is in danger of fading away, you know, and there's a moment where that fading away is paralleled by one of the characters in the magic world telling Luca that she fears that magic itself is fading out of the world and that people, she says, you think you don't need it anymore. You know, as she says, with your high definitions and your low expectations. And she says, one of these days you won't have it in the world anymore, and then you'll notice what you've lost.
Fiction is the magic? Storytelling is the magic?
I think, yes, in the broadest sense. I'm not saying only the novel, but I'm saying imaginative acts, whether books or films or music or, you know, all of that is the world of art, I think, adds to human life a dimension that is often underrated.
And where do video games fit in? Because this book is like a video game.
Well, there is a lot of video games. So there are video game metaphors used in it. I mean, well, one of the things is that this is simply something that's happened in the last 20 years since I wrote Haroon and the Sea of Stories, the explosion of this virtual reality. You know, and I thought it was just interesting to explore it. Also, of course,
some say it's not virtual anymore.
Yeah, exactly. It may be more real than this. Again, that borderline, you know, becomes blurred. But I just thought it's also the case that many video games have their structural origins in the world of myth and fable. You know, they're actually structured like old fables, old quest narratives, and so on. So it becomes quite naturally, if you're writing a quest narrative, which this book is, and after all, the quest for fire is one of the oldest of the quest narratives. It becomes a way of using a very modern language to talk about a very ancient story.
It's mythic, it's archetypical, it's universal.
Certainly universal. I mean, one of the things that I found when I was sort of reading around the book was that this particular story, I mean, there are two stories which appear to crop up in every single culture that human beings have ever created anywhere.
One is the journey and the other is father-son?
Well, no, the one is the quest for fire. One is the quest for fire, and the other is the creation of the sky god. You know, that's to say,
are you talking about real mythic? I was thinking about more the archetype of, because there is a journey here.
Oh,
and there's
yes,
a father son quest. And
sure,
stuff
sure. Like, yeah. I mean, those. I mean, I think in terms of which are the stories that we all tell. If you, whether you look at, I don't know, Greek or Chinese or Native American or anywhere in the world, you will find a story about the theft of fire. You know, in Native American culture, it's very often an animal or a friendly animal who goes and steals fire for whichever tribe it is. You know,
we have a dog named Bear and a bear named Dog.
Yes, and there's a wily coyote in here who is a fire thief.
Always the coyotes too. So you did a lot of brushing up on myth, or you read new myths too?
Well, I did a lot of brushing up on it because what I wanted to show or explore in the book was this idea that we all tell the same stories. You know, that this we live in this age when people talk about the clash of cultures and the clash of civilizations and so on. But actually, if you look at our cultures, we all tell the same stories. you know, and so this was, if you like, a kind of attempt to bring together all those stories, you know, all these different fables rush together to help Luca at one point, all these gods from all over the place rush in to help him solve his problem.
And you also are writing really for a mixed audience, bringing in young people and old people alike.
Well, I think that's also, you know, I think one of the things that Miss Rowling showed us is that books can do that. You know, that I think I remember when the Harry Potter books first started out, they used to publish different jackets. They used to have an adult jacket and a children's jacket, put them in different places in the bookstore so that grown-ups could read the stuff without being embarrassed that they were reading a children's book, you know. And then the books just became so colossally successful that you didn't need to do that anymore.
Do you think, I remember interviewing Ursula Le Guin and talking about how Miss Rowling, shall we say, borrowed a good deal from Miss Le Guin. Fair enough.
Well, her books do bring in elements from many, many different places. You can see bits of Tolkien in there. You can see bits of all sorts of people. I mean, actually, there's one thing I think she got from me. There's a bit in Harun and the Sea of Stories where the baddies, you know, have reversed eyes. They see in the dark. They're blind in the light. And so they have, instead of having light bulbs, they have dark bulbs. You know, they walk into rooms and they throw a switch. They switch on the darkness. And she has that. She has a thing called a deluminator in one of the books, which same thing. Turn the switch, turns on the darkness.
How about your villain here, Captain Ang? He's mythic, too, in many ways, too. Sort of like Captain Ahab in some ways.
Well, there's, you know, in this book, there's the one of the, there's lesser and bigger villains. There's the little villain, Captain Ang, who is, Ang is the Hindustani word for fire. And he's in the real world a kind of evil circus boss, but in the mythical world, he's one of the gatekeepers of the heart of magic. And gets, I'm happy to say, crushed. But the real bad guy is death, you know. And one of the things I worried about, there's this character whose name I stole from William Blake, in fact, Nobo Daddy.
What is that in Blake?
For Blake, it's a word for God. Uh-huh. And there's a poem that Blake wrote called To Nobo Daddy, which is a complaint against God. God is the absent father, you know, who's never there. He doesn't help you.
How heretical for Blake.
Yes, very. It's an anguished complaint against God. You know, I turn to you, you're never there. You don't say anything, you don't do anything. So Nobo Daddy is the God who isn't there, you know. In this book, I've used it more to be a figure of death than God. And I worried that it was too scary, you know, to have a figure who looks like your father, isn't your father, and is gradually filling up with your father's life, which he's sucking out of your father. I thought might be too scary for kids, you know.
And kids with other holographs and things of that sort?
Well, that's what I hoped. You know, anyway, I showed it to my son, Milan, and it turned out to be his favorite character. So it made me think that kids nowadays can handle a lot, you know. I mean, they're not nearly as innocent as I was when I was 12 or 13.
You're talking about all these wonderful myths that you're working with here, but there's also, you know, the influence I felt of Lewis Carroll. There's a cartoon-like quality, and I mean that in a positive sense. I mean, when I read Pynchon, I'm reading, you know, cartoon-like, yes. And you kind of draw from that same source of fire, so to speak.
Well, this, you know, I mean, cartoons at their best, you know, have a relationship, I think, to fable and myth, you know. I mean, Peanuts, I think, arrives at a kind of archetypal quality.
Gospel according to Peanuts, yeah.
Yes, you know, and Doonesbury, these great strips, I think, do manage to tap into archetypes of behavior in the same way as mythology does. I mean, I just steal from wherever I can, really.
We're talking to Major Thief Salman Rushdie. His new book is called Luca and the Fire of Life. Actually, as long as we're talking about cartoons here, I wanted to get some response to you. Nasrallah of Hezbollah blamed you for the Danish cartoons.
Oh, well.
I mean, how does one respond to that kind of invective? How did you respond?
Well, with contempt, really, I think. You know, and I think that's the only possible response. I mean, I think the thing about those cartoons, I think there's two separate things. One is, do you think they're funny? You know, which we can disagree about. And I myself thought one or two of them were funny, and several of them were not funny. Then there's the question of, if you were a picture editor on the newspaper when they're offered to you, would you print them? And again, I think different picture editors would come to different conclusions about that. That's just like an editorial journalistic decision, and no two newspapers would do it the same way. I think that's all up for discussion, you know. But then you get the subject of violent threats. And it seems to me when people respond to work like that with violent threats, it's a different conversation. Then it seems to me the best thing is every newspaper in the world should print the cartoons. You know, not because they love them, but in order to show that you don't get intimidated by that kind of threat. Because the one thing that is for sure is that if you give in to that kind of threat, there will be more such threats in future, you know, and you have to stop it. Also, I just wondered, first of all, there's the strange oxymoronic quality of a Danish cartoon, a funny thing in Danish. I don't know. It seems oxymoronic to me.
The Swedes are supposed to be more melancholy than the Danes.
Yes, so that's true. The Danes are jollier. But also, what would a respectful political cartoon look like? You know, you can't have it. I mean, the nature of the form is to be disrespectful. You know, the political cartoonist always finds weak points to criticize, satirize, dig at, poke fun at. That's what it is to be a cartoonist. So if you insist that cartoons should be respectful, you can't have cartoons, you know? So the only real answer is we all have to just deal with it. You know, you just have grow thicker skins and deal with it.
Wasn't there, in fact, a film that some wanted to censor that you thought was pretty trashy, Pakistani film called International Guerrillas? But you took the stand consistently and said, no, don't censor it.
No, that's right. It was a film in which I was the villain and people were supposed to kill me, and that was the happy ending. It was a really, really rotten movie. And actually getting it unbanned was the best thing that could have happened, because within a day or two, everybody realized it was a rotten movie and nobody went to see it.
Talk about movies, and not rotten movies, quite the contrary. They're making a movie of Midnight's Children?
I hope so, yeah. We're getting very close now. I mean, I think we've Deepa Mehta is going to direct it, you know, who directed the wonderful film Water that was nominated for an Oscar a few years ago, and the other films in that trilogy, Earth, Fire. A wonderful, lyrical, somehow simultaneously lyrical and epic filmmaker, you know, which I think are qualities well suited to have a go at Midnight's Children. I mean, I've written the screenplay, and everybody, thank goodness, after 2 years' work, everybody seems to finally like it.
Is this the first screenplay you've written?
No, it's not the first, but it's the first one that has a chance of getting made.
It's a very different process as far as labor, isn't it?
It's completely different, especially adaptation, because, you know, it's a very long novel. I mean, it's a 630-page novel, and the screenplay has ended up being, you know, 125. Now, that's, you know, a process of distillation that's not...
It's like pulling out parts of your intestines, I imagine.
More or less, yeah. But on the other hand, there's an interesting... I mean, I ended up finding it very interesting because it obliges you to ask yourself a very difficult question about what's essential, about what is the essence of this story. What is the story that you must tell without which it's not a film of Midnight's Children? You know, and how to answer that question in a way that cuts away enormous amounts of material, which actually is very enjoyable in the book, but does not serve that sort of shining little line that goes through the center of the book, which is the essence of the book. And to discover that 30 years after publishing the book, you know, is
challenging.
It's challenging.
To put it mildly.
Yeah.
Talking to Salman Rushdie, his new book is Luca and the Fire of Life. What's been the effect of that manifesto? It was a manifesto against religious and totalitarianism, and in fact, you came out... I saw an interview you did with Bill Moyers and said Muslims are the most oppressed by this totalitarianism, and that's what the manifesto says.
Well, I don't know that, you know, these things like this manifesto, they're all just drops in the bucket, you know, and you never know which is the drop that'll make the bucket overflow. You know, you just have to keep trying to fill up the bucket. I think that there is no question that within the Muslim world, there's an argument about the future, you know, and it's most dramatically present in Iran, where we saw all the protests against the rule of the Ayatollahs after the last election. So clearly there's a younger generation in Iran, and indeed a younger generation, I think, across the Muslim world, that really doesn't want to live this archaic, restricted life and wants what everybody wants. They
want to modernize.
They want to modernize. They want liberty. They want an ability to lead their lives as they would choose, rather than the way it's dictated to them by old men with beards. And we have to hope they prevail. You know, I mean, that's I think, the more interesting battle to me is the battle happening inside the Muslim world than the battle between the Muslim world and other parts of the world.
Are you hopeful?
No. No, but I mean, I think, you know, who was it? Is it Gramsci? I can't remember who said it about that you should have pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will.
or optimism of the heart, maybe.
Yeah.
We're talking again with Salman Rushdie. Happen to see you on Craig Ferguson. And again, there's that lighter side of you. You were having fun, weren't you?
Well, you know, I've been on his show a few times now. And it was just one of those things where we – something in our sense of humor just –
British schoolboy stuff?
Maybe that was it. Maybe it's just that kind of...
You were talking about pudendums. I don't know how to put that more...
No, he had started doing that in another segment of the show, and he just carried it on. In an earlier segment of the show, he'd been talking about what, as a child, his family had called the private parts, the male body, special names for it. I think in his family, they called it Bobby. I just was tickled by his sense of humor from the first time I went on the show, so I love going on it.
That side of you, though, I mean, not only the comedic side, but there's also a side of you that really gets tickled by and seems to enjoy showbiz, really. I mean, I know you have this, you've always harbored this desire to be an actor, but I mean, just hanging out with what some would call the beautiful people or the shallow people. You know?
Well, I mean, you know, we can have our shallow moments. We don't have to be deep all the time.
You're so associated with, you know, I mean, you're such an iconic figure associated with intellect and cerebrality and, you know, great art and so forth.
I'm still allowed to play, you know. I'm allowed to have fun sometimes.
Have to have fun, right? Yeah. And video games, do you play them?
No, not really. I mean, I'm pretty useless at them. But, you know, I've watched two generations of, because my sons are 18 years apart, I've watched two generations of children play them. There was a moment when my older son was younger when there was a frightening moment when I actually became quite competent at Super Mario. And that was alarming.
Alarming.
But then I stopped. And it's one of those things, video games, that it's not like riding a bicycle. If you try and start again after not having played for 20 years, you're back at zero. You know, you have to relearn everything.
Didn't you also say that Nintendo should be dropped on Iran at one point?
That's what we call a joke. You know?
I think it was Howard Stern who said if they'd be bombarded with porn, it would change everything. But you have this green revolution that really wants to change.
Yeah.
You
know? I mean, I just remember how after the Vietnam War ended, how the thing that changed the relations between Vietnam and the United States was American culture, that everybody wanted all this stuff. You know, everybody wanted McDonald's and Starbucks and Next and Gap and et cetera. And suddenly, America is very popular in Vietnam because of American culture. And so I thought that could be applied, that idea could be applied elsewhere.
Of course, that's the kind of, in fact, we had Reza Aslan, whom you know, mm-hmm. on earlier this week, talking about his new book, Tablet and Pen. And the first essay in there is by Khalil Gibran, and it's all about the toxicity of the West. Which goes to the heart of that concern and paranoia about these kinds of things like McDonald's and Starbucks and what.
Yeah, well, I mean, sometimes the West is toxic. That's true.
We're talking to the definitely non-toxic Salman Rushdie, and I'm going to open the phone lines and invite those of you listening to join us. We welcome your phone calls, and you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, join the program at 866-733-6786. Again, our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Or send us an email, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And Salman Rushdie and I will be on stage at the Herbst Theater this evening. I think there's still a few tickets left as part of the City Arts and Lecture Series. His new book is Luca and the Fire of Life. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, spending the hour with Salman Rushdie. Always a delight to have him here. His new book is Luca and the Fire of Life, and we're going to go to your calls and emails and web postings here shortly. I want to talk a little bit about atheism, though. You're out as an atheist.
Yes.
And there came up this debate when we had Sam Harris on a few weeks ago, because essentially in his new book he argues that you can have moral values and you can have morality without God. And mm-hmm. I think any thoughtful person would certainly agree with that. But he was looking at science really as a way to provide moral values, and saying essentially the thesis was science can do that. And there is this ongoing terrible, except for Francis Collins, who heads the NEH, there's this, you know, is an evangelical Christian, this terrible divide in this country between those of religious, strong religious faith and the more militant atheists, let's say, like Sam.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering where you stand on this whole idea that science can provide a complete moral foundation, because it almost seems like pipe dreaming to me, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an admirer of Sam Harris's, as the other, you know, Dawkins, Hitchens gang. I mean, that's, you know, much more my team, if you know, than
the gang that shoots God, as opposed to the gang that can't shoot straight.
Exactly, exactly. But I think I have a slightly different take on things than they do. For instance, you know, in this book, in Luca, The Fire of Life, one of the ideas behind the book is that the origin of all story was sacred story. You know, I mean, that's where it began. What we now think of as the Greek myths were originally the Greek religion. You know, what we now think of as the Egyptian myths were originally the religion of ancient Egypt. You know, and that's true across the world. These ancient stories were originally the texts of living religions. And what came out of that were some of the most beautiful stories that are available to us, and ones which contain the greatest amount of truth, you know, that human beings have ever managed to set down. In concentrated form, you know, and they, for me, have been very enriching. You know, I've gone to the mythology repeatedly as a way of trying to think about and understand stories that I was trying to tell. So I have enormous respect for that, you know, enormous respect for it. I think, obviously, there was a certain point in the history of the human race where story became detached from the sacred, you know, and there was then also secularized and non-religious storytelling. But the origin is without any question, you know, sacred. And so if the job you do has an origin in that, you better pay attention to it, you know. So I also think where I differ from someone like Christopher Hitchens is that Christopher thinks, you know, religion equals bad, you know.
And, so he's likening it to child abuse, I think.
And stupid, yeah. And so on.
It's a very contemptuous attitude.
Yeah. And I can see that. You often see coming out of the mouths of religious people, whether popes or ayatollahs, incredibly stupid stuff. But what I think myself is that if you are religious and if it brings to you nourishment, sustenance, inspiration, hope, whatever, you know, whatever you get from it, you get from it. That's not my business. You know, that's not my, why would I tell you that that's a bad thing for you to have? It becomes my business, I think, when it comes into the public arena. So I'm very strongly opposed to the presence of religion in public life, because I think it has been, in general, harmful. No particular religion, you know, religion in general. The rise of radical Christianity in this country, I think, has not been beneficial to the public life of this country. The rise of radical Islam, we don't have to even discuss, you know. And even in a country in India where I come from, a religion like Hinduism, which was never thought to be radical or violent, you know, has developed a radical extremist violent wing in the last 20, 30 years. So,
but can you separate Hinduism, for example, from the work of Gandhi? Can you separate Christianity from Martin Luther King or Islam from Malcolm X, the later Malcolm X?
Well, I mean, obviously, not everything done by religious people is reprehensible. You know, but the where I agree with, you know, the Hitchens, Dawkins, Harris group is that in the end, it seems to me like a simplification of thought that I don't want. You know, I don't need to be told that there is an ultimate arbiter from whom I get my moral sense.
You don't.
I don't.
But there are many
who do.
Obviously who do.
That's that's what I'm saying. For in terms of people's private choices, I see it as not my business. You know, if that's what gives people strength and ethics and credibility about the world they live in, you know, fine. I mean, but I'm saying when it becomes a public issue, I have an issue with it, because I think when almost every time, not every time, but almost every time that religion has moved into the political field, it has resulted in conservatism and repression. And it doesn't even have to be the kind of religion that believes in God, you know, because communism was a religion that didn't believe in God. It's simply the idea of having a total explanation of the world. You know, any ideology which says the world is like this and we know it because we have, you know, the following sanctions of divine judgment or Marxism that tells us so. The moment you think you know the explanation to everything, you know, tyranny is only a step away.
We're going to go to our callers. Quick thing, though, about religion. I couldn't help thinking Fire Alive, again, because it's so elemental and so much a part of even sacred literature. I was thinking Moses and the Burning Bush, but also thinking about Zoroastrianism.
Yes.
And it does certainly...
Which is a fire religion.
Yeah, of course it is. Plays a key kind of role here.
Yeah, right? I mean, I think one of the things that was very inspirational to me in writing this book was to look at the way in which people have thought about fire, both sacred and secular. You know, and fire is clearly something other than just the thing flickering in the fireplace. Fire is a metaphor of passion, you know, of creativity, of love.
And also destruction.
And also destruction, yes. And that link between creation and destruction is one of the things, actually, that many religions have made. You know, I mean, the greatest god of Hinduism, Shiva, is both the creator and the destroyer. Mm-hmm. You know? That idea that the same thing that creates can also destroy, the same force in human life that is the creator is also the destroyer, is, of course, well, at the heart of the idea of the myth of fire.
You don't believe in any way, shape, or form in reincarnation, do you?
I do not.
Okay, just want to get that on the record, because
no.
There are some reincarnation things going on in your new novel. And
I know, but these are what we call fairy tales.
Of course. Okay, just want to get that on the record. Let's go to our calls, and we go first to you, Timothy. Good morning.
Hey, Michael, thank you, and I'm so excited to be on the phone and talk to one of my biggest heroes, Mr. Rushdie. And I want to ask him about, or give him compliments for his unfairness during the, you know, the death threats and all that stuff. And the question is Mr. Rushdie, like, you know, Hitchens, and I read Hitch 22 and whatnot. He had a great chapter on you and your friendship, and he really admired you. But, like, what you know.
Let's not put that in past tense. Still does admire
him. Still does.
Exactly. What did it take? It took moral courage or something to stand up to the intimidation.
Well, I guess so. You know, I mean, I think writers are quite obstinate creatures, in my experience, and not very good at being shut up. I mean, it did take, obviously, it took a certain amount of, you know, taking a deep breath and just deciding not to be bullied. But I also had an enormous amount of support from friends, from people like Christopher Hitchens, you know, and one of the things that experience showed me was who my friends were, you know, and who was there, who stood up, you know, who was the friend in need, who stood up to be counted when it was actually important to do that. And that's a very interesting lesson to learn about life, and you can take away a good thing from that, you know. I mean, I think, yes, of course, there were all those threats, and it was a difficult time for me. But it was also a time when all sorts of people behaved with incredible courage and principle, you know, and it feels, looking back at it, it feels, you know, remarkable to have been at the center of such a kind of collective act of principle and courage.
I remember, thank you for the call, Timothy. I remember Hitchens was very angry at some of these bookstores who said, you know, we're not going to sell the satanic verses, and came down very hard on them rhetorically. Does that still burn in you, that kind of resentment?
No, it doesn't, actually. And truthfully, that moment of that kind of wobble on the part of the chains was relatively brief. I mean, it was really only about a week or so, you know. And then all sorts of people, like Christopher, like their own employees, like many other writers. I mean, I remember, actually, a writer who doesn't get enough credit for having helped in this matter is Stephen King, you know, who had read the Satanic Verses and liked it. And when the chains were trying to chicken out of selling it, he started calling the presidents of the chains and saying, if you don't sell that book, you better take mine off the shelves.
You know who I interviewed around that time, and I wonder how you feel about him now, was Cat Stevens. He came on the air and said he would not talk about the fatwa, and I said fine, because I knew the first caller would ask about it. I mean, about his statements on it and so forth. That's the only time I agreed to any kind of pressure like that, but I thought it's going to come up in the call, it's ridiculous to...
Well, all I'd say is he hasn't been Cat Stevens for a long time. You know, I mean, when I was a college student, I had my copy of Tea for the Tillerman, you know, and I mean, I don't deny his melodic gift, but he hasn't been that guy for a long time, you know, and he's been another person which is much less congenial, you know, and it's not just a question of what he said about me. I mean, he's talked to British journalists within the last several years about his support for stoning women to death for adultery. You know, I mean, he runs a school in London. I mean, he's the founder of a school in London, an Islamic school whose own mission statement says that its purpose is to ensure the subjugation of the world to Islam. So, you know,
he seems to have lost the gift, too, doesn't he?
And he does seem to have lost the gift. So there you are. That's what religion will do for you. It'll ruin your music.
Michael from Concord joins us. Hi, Michael. Michael, are you there?
I'm here.
Please, go ahead.
A noise in the background. I'm trying to get away from it.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you said. You're trying to get away from
I had a generator in the background that just went off, so I'm getting away from it. But I'm here.
Okay, please speak to us.
So I recently finished the Satanic Verses, and I want to just tell Salman Rushdie that's a great book. I love it.
Thank you.
But I would like some resolution. I know it's a work of fiction, but the butterfly girl, Aisha, who leads the pilgrimage to Mecca, the resolution I want, I would request from Salman is, does she get to Mecca? That's not very apparent in the book.
Mm. No, I think it's a decision you have to make for yourself. I mean, there's a story, this is a storyline in the Satanic Verses based on an incident that really happened where a mystical leader, mystical Islamic leader in real life in Pakistan, in the novel it happens in India, convinced the villagers where, it was a man in real life, it was a woman in the novel, where he lived, that if they went to the water, the water's edge, the water would part and there would be a miracle and they would be able to walk across the ocean bed and make a pilgrimage to the Muslim holy places. And people believed him, and a whole village more or less drowned in the sea. You know, and it was just such an extraordinary episode because and one of the things that made it extraordinary is
work for Moses, didn't it?
Yes, exactly. This was Moses too. You know, this time it didn't work. and so I just used that as the basis of a story. As to whether the miracle really takes place or not in the novel, I think is deliberately left for the reader to decide.
How do you feel about the way things are in Pakistan now? Again, pessimistic?
Oh, you know, Pakistan, I think, well, I don't know. It's too dangerous to be pessimistic in a way, because I think Pakistan is right at the sharp end of what's going to happen to all of us in the next generation or so. You know, whether we can solve the problem of Islamic radicalism and terrorism, the answer to that question is in Pakistan. It's not in Afghanistan. Whether the leaders of Pakistan, both military and civilian, and the intelligence leaders can be persuaded that their own interest is best served in moving against the radicals to whom they have given safe haven for so long, or not. That's the big question of our time, I think. Because if they can be so persuaded, then there is a chance of winning that war. You know? And if they can't be so persuaded, then essentially there isn't a chance.
It's ironic in some ways that many people thought the most volatile region globally was the Middle East, meaning, you know, the Arab world, mm-hmm. Israel, and mm-hmm. so forth. And, of course, it is highly volatile. But remember Bill Clinton, when he left his presidency, said, no, the most volatile place in the world is India, Pakistan.
Yeah, well, not India. India is a stable country.
No, he meant ongoing conflict over Kashmir and
yeah,
all
but I
that.
Think it's the other frontier. I think it's the Pakistan-Afghan frontier. That's really the India-Pakistan thing, yes, it's bad. And Pakistan continues to harbor groups that have attacked India, as, for example, in the terrible terrorist attacks in Bombay recently. But I think the dangerous frontier is the other one right now, the western frontier of Pakistan.
I'm struck by the fact that you still say Bombay and not Mumbai.
Oh, lots of people in Bombay say Bombay. You know, yeah. I mean, I bet you that if you go to Saigon, there's relatively few people who call it Ho Chi Minh City.
We go to more calls. Kate joins us. Hi, Kate.
Hi. I really love this program, and as I listen on, there are many things I would like to say. But I called because I was really taken with your quotation about optimism and pessimism. Mm-hmm. And before I could find a pencil, I lost half of it. We should have optimism of the intellect and pessimism of the... And I couldn't remember.
It's the other way around. Pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will.
Very good. Thank you for the call. Let me go to more of your calls. Neil joins us. Hi, Neil.
Yeah, the last time you were on the station, on this program, Mr. Rushdie, and that was quite some time ago, I asked you what you thought of Graham Greene. You replied that you liked him very much, but I forgot to ask you which of his novels you like. Can I do a follow-up right now?
Oh, yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, I was a big fan of Greene. I actually like some of the books that he initially thought were minor works, which he classified as entertainments. Mm-hmm. Later in his life, he dropped that classification because he realized that they were some of his best books. And I think Our Man in Havana is an absolutely wonderful
book.
Wonderful book. There's a very early novel of his called The Ministry of Fear, which is, I think, the best novel written about wartime London. It's about London during the Blitz. And the story of the novel revolves around a cake. Something as fragile as a cake that has to be carried across the city in the middle of the Blitz. And the cake may or may not contain secret messages and spy information and so on. It's just a wonderful idea of the fragility of this piece of bakery going through a city that's being bombed to pieces. It's a beautiful, beautiful book.
Thank you for the call. Now, you've been living in the States now. I mean, teaching at Emory and everything, and you had this dual identity, this hybridized identity for so many years, British and Indian. Becoming more American, you think?
Well, I think, I've been living in New York for, what is it now? It's almost 12 years now.
Yeah.
And the Emory thing, it's only 4 weeks a year, but it's been interesting for me as a kind of way of doing something I really wanted to do, which is to little bit explore the American South, because I've always loved the literature of the American South. I've loved Faulkner and Flannery O'Connor and Eudora Welty and so on. And yet I'd never really spent any time in the South. And Atlanta is a good place to jump off and go explore. Mm-hmm. Go to Oxford, Mississippi and see Faulkner's world, go to Milledgeville and see Flannery O'Connor's home and so on. So I've been able to do a bit of that. But yeah, I think after 12 years, I've always felt in my life more attached to cities than to nations. I would think of myself as a Bombay boy and as a Londoner and as a New Yorker. And that seems to be more naturally where my affiliations go,
With cities,
yeah. Yes. I'm not very good at nationalism, but I do feel great loyalty to cities that I've loved.
A question from a listener who expresses great admiration of all your books and asks, if you had one free day to do nothing but pleasure reread any book from cover to cover, what would that book be?
Well, right now, one of the things that was so inspirational for me writing Luca and the Fire of Life was the work of Lewis Carroll. And I am fortunate that I went to one of the things I'm proud of is I went to the same school as Lewis Carroll. I went to rugby school in England. In many other ways, not a very good experience, but I did feel proud to be in the same place.
Notwithstanding his alleged pedophilia?
The thing about the pedophilia, there's another view about that. The later research seems to show that it wasn't that he was misbehaving with the children, but that he had an affair with the nanny. And that's why Alice's family distanced themselves from him. And, the truth is that Alice herself, throughout her life, defended him. She said he was never inappropriate. He was always just a good friend. And she was very, very loyal towards him. So the fact is that the person about whom it said that he behaved inappropriately always said that he didn't. So I think we could give him the benefit of that doubt. But just these books are so magical, And for me, thinking about writing Luca and the Fire of Life, I thought a lot about Lewis Carroll writing Through the Looking Glass, thinking how might it be to go back 7 years after you wrote this book, which had already become a classic, and try and follow that. It must have been he must have been a bit scared. I was a bit scared that people would think about this book, well, the first one was good, but this one not so much. And in the case,
act of courage?
You have to try very hard to keep your second book up to the mark that you've set for yourself. And in his case, of course, the mark was very, very high indeed. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, one of the greatest books written in the English language.
One of the things that I see you and Carol have in common is just an extraordinary playfulness with language and a love of language which is palpable.
Well, I think it's, books are made of sentences, aren't they? And And in the end, the joy of reading, to speak as a reader, the joy of reading is in language. You know, if I find it very difficult to read books when there's no pleasure in the language. And even if they're very worthy and in some ways good books. I mean, I can think of writers that in one way I admire, but I find their prose difficult.
There's also a lot of Hindi punning and stuff like that in your work that I miss as a reader because
well,
I don't know the language.
There's just a little of it. There's not a lot of it. There's just a little sprinkling of it. And in the first book, in Haroon, I actually put a little glossary at the back of terms mm-hmm. that had derived from Indian languages. And this time, there's not much additional, really. I mean, probably the only additional play on words is you were mentioning the villain Captain Aag, and that Aag is, as any Indian would know, is the Hindi word for fire. So he also comes from that fire world, you know, and is indeed fiery. But otherwise, there's not that much extra this time. Anybody who read Haroon would know the words, really.
On we go, and we bring in a caller from Massachusetts, from Dartmouth, Massachusetts. Noah, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today, Mr. Rushing?
Hello, nice to talk to you.
I have a tremendous amount of respect for your books and what you did as far as, you know, speaking out against radicalism and religion, but I wanted to know if you were raised with any particular religion as a child, because myself, I'm an atheist as an adult, but I was brought up in a Catholic and Methodist home, and I was brought to church, but I never actually really ever believed it. It wasn't until I started reading
yeah.
and find other people in literature that didn't believe that I realized it was okay not to.
No, I mean, my family, officially was an Indian Muslim family, but neither of my parents was in really to any degree observant, you know. So we were brought up. My sisters and I were brought up in a very very non-religious atmosphere.
But you had a grandfather who was fairly devout.
Yes, my mother's father was indeed very religious. I mean, went on the pilgrimage to Mecca and all that, and various other members of my family, you know, uncles, aunts, cousins, were more religious than my own little family, my nuclear family, was not really. So I always felt that it's one of the gifts my parents gave me was the ability to be skeptical about religion because they were too. My father much more than my mother, but my mother too. The extent of religion in our household was that we did not eat pork.
Let me thank the caller for that. We'll go to San Jose. Shamita, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, my question to Mr. Rushdie is, I've read his book, Midnight Children, and I was wondering if the movie is going to be as captivating as the book itself.
Well, we will try. We will try.
That's the hope, I'm sure.
Yeah, we are definitely aiming for that, you know. I mean, look, the worst that could happen is it'll be a lousy movie, which means the book's still there. But we're going to try our very best to make a really good film. And as I say, I think it's in very good hands.
You have to be an alchemist almost, don't you, to turn a book like that into a movie?
Yes, and you have to have luck. You know, you have to have performances that work on the day and a kind of, as you say, alchemy between the actors, you know, that creates a certain kind of magic on the screen. And you know, you can hope for that and you can do your best in casting the thing well. I mean, my view of the movies in general is if you can get a good script and the right actors, then after that, you know, you just point the camera at them. You know, and if you've done that work correctly, the film has a chance of working. And I mean, at the moment, we're still casting. We haven't finished yet, but I'm really very pleased with the way it's going. We're getting some wonderful people.
It's such a hallowed and revered novel, though. I mean, it's the Booker of Bookers and all of that.
Yeah, but you have to forget all that. You know, you have to forget
well, you go
all that.
And I remember the first time when I was a young graduate student and I had read Ulysses, and I thought, there's a film of Ulysses that just come out. And I thought, how are they going to turn this into film? And it's impossible. And I went in sort of with these sort of recalcitrant purist views or whatever. And then the film came on, and I enjoyed it completely apart from Ulysses.
Yeah.
Right?
It's not bad at all. Yeah. You know, I mean, Joseph Strick's film.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, Barbara Jefford, who plays Molly Bloom, who delivers the famous soliloquy,
yeah.
It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah,
it's absolutely brilliant. You know, and so, yeah, you can do it. I think you just – that's the trick is what you said, is that you in the end have to think of it as a separate work. And I think of the film of Midnight's Children as being – if you like, a cousin of the book, you know, being
first cousin, second cousin.
Well, I mean, I hope it's a close relative.
don't know about first cousins. I just was reading about Phil Spector. Do you know that he was the result of first cousins?
Oh, I did not know that.
I didn't know that either. We had Joel Selvin on as a rock critic, and I know you have you're like me, a kind of rock aficionado. But let's try to get another caller in here, and this is another Timothy. Good morning.
Yes, Mr. Rusty, wondering if you can find a link between the imagination and intention in Anglo-American law jurisprudence. There's no criminal act without the sufficient criminal intent. And I'm wondering, were you impressed by the recent New Jersey case where the husband was acquitted of raping his wife? He was a Muslim, and the judge said that it was that because the defendant had a belief, had a, in his imagination, he was not doing a criminal act because he didn't have the criminal intent necessary.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the case, but in general, I don't think that the crime of rape can be exonerated on the basis of your deciding that it's not rape.
Yeah, I think that's well said as a response. We had Reza Aslan on earlier this week, as I said, and he feels that I think appropriately that there's been a kind of neglect of in the world canon of literature from what he calls broadly the Middle East. He's talking about South Asia as well as North Africa, Middle East, and so forth. Do you agree?
Well, yeah, just because the world of those languages has remained closed somehow to European, certainly, readers, because, first of all, relatively little of it is translated. Other than the Arabian Nights, you know, and a few of the great writers. Some of the stuff that's translated is not well translated. And there has been a lack of interest. I mean, I was hugely influenced as a child by the great Urdu poet of India and Pakistan, Faiz, who was a family friend and was my first model of what a writer should be like. So, yes, I'm all in favor of learning about that world.
Well, we learn a lot when you're here. How glad to have you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Always a pleasure. Thank
you. The book is Luca and the Fire of Life, and we'll be together again this evening at the Herbst Theater as part of the City Arts and Lectures series. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to extend thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell, and to our interns, Suki Lewis, Aiden Stone, Elena Cattavani. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.